Following the bombing of Afghanistan in 2001 and 2, the U.S. wound up with military bases in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Georgia, Yemen, and Djibouti. And following its bombing of Iraq and its invasion of Iraq in 2003, the U.S. wound up with Iraq. This is not very subtle foreign policy. It's certainly not covert operations. The men who run the American empire are not easily embarrassed. And that's the way the empire grows, a base in every region of the world, ready to be mobilized to put down any threat to the empire, real or imagined. 62 years after the end of World War II, the U.S. still has major bases in Germany and Japan. 54 years after the end of the Korean War, the U.S. still has tens of thousands of armed forces in South Korea. And who knows, they're now building the biggest U.S. embassy and base in Iraq. They are not going to be leaving, not in my lifetime, and maybe not in my son's lifetime. He's only 25. Let me turn now from all these foreign issues to something not quite as depressing here at home. I'm glad the Democrats won the majorities in Congress, but most of you probably know, most of these new Democrats are hardly even liberal, never mind progressive or radical. And that's not by chance. They were chosen by the party because of their moderate views about Iraq and Israel, for example. The person in charge of choosing and financing these new candidates for the Democrats was the congressman from Illinois, Rahm Emanuel, a man who served in the Israeli army. So that shows you what they had in mind. Ideology is a very important concept, and I think that most people are rather confused by it, which is due to no small measure to the fact that the media are confused by it, or at least that they pretend to be confused. Take the talk shows, where they present one person who's a conservative, and one person who's a liberal, and they are thus giving you a balanced point of view, right? But the conservative is typically a neoconservative who is on the far right end of the political spectrum. The liberal is someone who's ever so slightly to the left of center. This is not a balanced point of view at all. So a more appropriate balance to a conservative would be a radical leftist or progressive or Marxist. American liberals are typically closer to conservatives on U.S. foreign policy than they are to those on the left. And so the educational value of so-called balanced TV programs can be more harmful than helpful, because the average American sees this and he thinks, well, that's all there is to know. Those are the two points of view. I've gotten the full picture, right? The conservative way of bombing them to hell, or the liberal way of imperialism with a human face. Neither seriously questions whether the American empire or the American people or the world needs the American empire. Similarly, if they discuss a domestic issue like health care, you get Mickey Mouse proposals from both sides to continue the system of for-profit health care, the conservative Mickey Mouse plan or the liberal Mickey Mouse plan. Sometimes, to show a variation, one of them will offer a Donald Duck variation. The fundamental difference between liberalism and Marxism is that liberalism sees a problem, such as America's role as the world's bully, as bad policy, while the Marxist sees it as something that flows logically from the U.S. economic and military interests and systems. When a liberal sees a beggar, he says, the system isn't working. When a Marxist sees a beggar, he says, the system is working. Believe it or not, I do find things to be encouraged about. For one, I think the American people today are seeing through the lies much more. They have much more healthy cynicism and skepticism. I think it's very widespread, even in the media. I often, these days, in the past couple of years, have heard or seen interviews of the president or Cheney or Rumsfeld by the media, and they ask much tougher questions than they used to ask. And if they get one of the baloney answers, they don't stop there. They persist. I think it's since again and again. They actually insist that Bush or Cheney answered the question, and that's very encouraging. I'm not saying that these reporters have seen the light, quote-unquote, but they're not in the dark as much as they used to be. I think they're simply tired of being lied to, and it's about time. And then, of course, I'm encouraged by the anti-war movement and the peace and justice movement and the anti-globalization and environmental movement. There's a lot to be optimistic about insofar as raising people's consciousness. I can't predict what all this will lead to, but I think it'll put a brake on the empire. It's not like in the 1960s, where once the war came to an end, most of the protesters returned to pursuing a career and making money. I think the activists of today have a higher consciousness. They're not going to go away so easily, even if and when the U.S. leaves Iraq. So I urge all of you, if you haven't already done so, to join one of these movements. It can be very exciting and even fun, except, of course, when a cop is using your head as a drum. Let me close now with the two laws of politics which came out of the Watergate scandal of the 1970s, which I like to cite. The first Watergate law of American politics states, no matter how paranoid you are, what the government is actually doing is worse than you imagine. The second law of Watergate states, don't believe anything until it's been officially denied. Both laws are still in the books, and I thank you.
You're listening to a talk by William Bloom, author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II. We'll continue with questions from the audience. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW.
Yeah, of course, I'd love to. I also would welcome questions from anybody who doesn't share my views. If anyone like that is here, please.
One of the constant denials we've been hearing for the last few years is the draft. Don't worry, the draft's not coming back. There's nothing to worry about. The Pentagon's against it, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, they've hired 10,000 members of the draft boards, changed all the rules, extending it out to age 35, and talking about women registering along with men. Could you update us with anything on the draft that you've perceived, particularly in point of this view you have that denial is the official plan?
Yeah. Well, I think your information is more than I know about. I have no more to add to that. I wouldn't put it past them to have the draft again. If they should get bogged down elsewhere besides Afghanistan and Iraq, they're going to need lots more people. And they'll find some excuse. If they decide to have the draft again, I'm sure they'll find some excuse. But I have no other information about that.
Yes, sir. I was wondering, what do you suppose was the motivation of the party who recommended your book, who purports to be bin Laden, and who do you suppose really is this person?
I think it was bin Laden. I don't think the government was behind that thing. Why would the government want to publicize a book like mine? It makes no sense whatsoever to me. And there's no doubt in my mind it was bin Laden on that tape.
I had one suggestion for who that might be, and that's some mysterious, genuine patriot who is within the CIA who might choose to recommend a book that has some real ideas.
Well, that's even more far-fetched than saying it was not bin Laden. I mean, that's a bit too much for my taste, frankly.
Okay.
I mean, if you... Yeah.
One other minor thing. You know that none of the alleged terrorist names ever appeared on any of the flight lists of any of the planes.
That's
and
a question.
Seven of them, at least, are known to be alive.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Of course, there were many questions about 9/11 which are not answered and which were ignored by the 9/11 commission. Yeah. I have my own questions in my mind, but I'm not... Well, I'll stop right there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you think that the activities in Latin America are having an effect on the empire, or will they have an effect on the empire?
That's why Bush is in South America right now. He's not going down as a tourist. Oh, he's going down there to counter the influence of Chavez of Venezuela. That's why he's there, and they're choosing the countries he's chosen are those which are in danger of moving too far to the left, like Uruguay and Brazil and
Colombia.
Mexico really has moved that way. The election last year was stolen from the left. So he's going down there to forestall any further erosion of U.S. influence. And so I think the effect upon U.S. foreign policy is very healthy. And he's being greeted the way he should be greeted, by crazed mobs, you know.
What do you think will happen if Mexico really erupts the way it looks like it may do?
Well, Mexico did have an eruption for a long time, all of last year almost, you know, and they didn't succeed in even forcing the government of Oaxaca to resign. So I admire what they did, but in the end, it was not totally successful, except as far as change. But as far as affecting the thought of people in Mexico, I'm sure it did a great deal of good. So we'll have to see what happens in the future. But as of now, I'm not expecting any great sudden change.
So when you tell people about what you do, you know, about foreign policy, and they say, why? What's America have to gain? And then you tell them the reason, you know, for power. And then in response, they say, I get this a lot, I hear this a lot. They say, well, what's the point? How does that benefit us? How does being the world's biggest superpower benefit us? I mean, people, individuals like you and I get that a lot from people. How do you respond to people like that?
Well, are they asking that question because they share your views or because they don't share your views?
No, they don't.
Well, that seems like an odd question for them to ask then. I mean, that's a question I would expect someone who's opposed to the war to ask.
Well, for starters, they don't believe that it's happening, okay?
That what happened?
That's, you know, America's foreign policy. They don't believe a lot of the things are happening, you know, the bases, you know, et cetera. And then if they even do, they say, okay, so America wants to be the world's biggest power, but why? What, you know, how does that...
You mean they're asking why would our leaders do a thing like this?
Yes, and then how does it benefit us?
Oh. You know, like, well, it benefits us. If us means the corporations, for example, our interventions benefit the corporations fantastically.
Yeah.
Not just the oil corporations, which is obvious, but I mean, like Halliburton and Bechtel and a bunch of others, they benefit for every intervention. All the defense companies, the ones who manufacture the planes and the bombs, and that's a major reason for our interventions. But they also benefit, our interventions benefit the whole financial sector. One of the reasons we invaded Iraq was to overturn their decision to use the euro instead of the dollar for oil transactions. And that was done within weeks of the U.S. occupation. They canceled the policy of the government of Iraq to use the euro in place of the dollar. That really scares the people here. So that benefits us, meaning certain elements in finance. I mean, us is not you or I. Us is the corporations and the banks and so on. And as far as reasons we invaded Iraq, there's also a major reason was the Israel lobby. They played a big role in this. So it benefits Israel. It benefits all the politicians here who are beholden to the Israeli lobby. They win points by supporting the war. So those are some of the factors involved in the invasion.
And then the second thing I hear a lot too is, well, my life is fine. I live fine. Why should I care? Do you get that a lot? I mean, as far as domestic policy.
Yes. Well, I've never actually heard that. I think even someone on the far right has just enough sense to know that that makes him look pretty low down, you know, just enough sense to realize that. So that's probably very uncommon. I once estimated, this is purely an estimate, that of that type, the type which can't be reached in any way, is no more than 15% of the population. And I would say, forget about them. Focus on the remaining 85% who can be reached, and many have been. You know, this 15%, if the government invaded their homes and kidnapped and killed their firstborn, they would still support the government's foreign policy. There is no way to reach them. And, you know, this person you're talking about, as an example, there's no way. So don't even waste your time.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bloom, we see all that movement in Latin America now, you know, going against U.S. Interests and imperialism, Chavez and all these other guys. And in Iraq war, Afghanistan war, United States has been exposed, you know, utter bankruptcy of U.S. Morality and U.S. policy. Do you think the end of the empire is near in perhaps in next 50 years?
How many years?
50.
Yeah. My ability to predict the future is no better than yours or anybody else's. I cannot say when the empire will come to an end. It will. Not in my lifetime, I'm afraid. I will not live to enjoy that spectacle. But all empires come to an end. There's no reason why our empire should be an exception. But I couldn't say when. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Bloom.
Hi.
In terms of American empire and in the upcoming presidential elections, do you think there will be much difference in American foreign policy if we elect a Democrat over a Republican? And second part of the question is to send a message to the Democrats to move more to the left. Would you advise voting for a third party?
Would I advise what?
Voting for a third party.
Yeah. Well, we have sent that message already. In 2000, Ralph Nader got 3 or 4 million votes, and you think that would send a message, but it didn't. I mean, they chose Kerry the next time. He was even worse than Gore. So I don't know if those people are reachable. It's very sad. I mean, I don't get any pleasure out of knocking the Democrats. It's very sad. There are a few good people amongst them, but that's about it. I'm glad that they are in majority of Congress because of a certain domestic issues. But on foreign policy, it's only because they're in opposition now and they have control of certain committees that they're saying certain things that they weren't saying before. So I don't know, I wouldn't even say that they're very sincere, but I'm glad they're saying these things. I'm glad they're pressing Bush to state a timeline for Iraq and so on. I'm glad for purely psychological reasons. I mean, I don't know if it makes any difference in the hard facts of life, but we all of us need to get some kind of satisfaction from all our protests. And so it's nice to have these small satisfactions where occasionally a person in Congress is now asking questions which were not being asked before. But those are small satisfactions. I don't know where it's going to lead to. I don't know if they'll have the courage to really push forward to force the U.S. out of Iraq. I don't know.
Thank you.
How would you choose to answer someone who believes that making the world safer, global capitalism, is a good thing?
The question is how would I convince someone who believes that making the world safe for global capitalism is a good thing? Is the person a capitalist that you were speaking to?
Definitely.
Ask him what they know of the details. Ask him to tell you how much they know about the effect of global capitalism in, say, Indonesia or Angola or Ecuador. Just ask him to tell you what they know about the results, the effects of what happens when a multinational moves in and wipes out the local businesses. So, and you'll see that this person probably has no idea of what happens. And so that, I think, is a good argument. You point out that they're speaking out of total ignorance, and I think that's an effective method. I'm a firm believer in the use of embarrassment in argument. I really am. People they wouldn't admit that they're embarrassed, but when they think about it, it hits home. So I enjoy embarrassing people like that.
Thank you.
Mr. Bloom, I wrote my question down so I wouldn't forget what to say when I got up here. So many people get stage fright. I wondered what inspired you to write your book. I had an opportunity to read a little bit of your book, and hopefully I'll get a chance to finish it. Yeah, I want to know what inspired you to write your book. And in addition, I'd like to know what developed your views or what inspired your views to be who you are today.
Yeah, I'm a product of the Vietnam era. I didn't fight in Vietnam. I fought at home. But that molded my views very much. In the 60s, I happened to fall into a discussion group with people who I didn't even know what a Marxist was, hardly, but they were Marxists, some of them, heavens forbid. And they were discussing Vietnam and Cuba and asking questions of the kind I had never heard before. I didn't even know people thought in such ways. And then this group, when the anti-war movement began to blossom, we in this group, we changed ourselves from a discussion group into the Washington Committee to End the War in Vietnam. And that's when I became an activist. And my reading material changed quite a bit. And that's what led to my writing. I began my writing in the underground press. I was one of the founders of the Washington Free Press back in the 60s. That's how I began writing. But I didn't, my first book came out many years later.
Hi. First of all, I want to say how impressed I was this afternoon. I went to your website, and I think you're a most generous man because I saw so many links to so many articles that you've written that you don't have to pay for or send away for anything, which I plan to enjoy over the coming months. Anyway, the other night, Joseph Cirincione addressed the Physicians for Social Responsibility, talking about, you know, not the least of which that we have 8,000 warheads, but that actually two places where we've gotten made some headway about nuclear, what do I want to say, power and arms is Libya and Korea, where we actually worked deals and didn't go in, you know, trying to bomb somebody to get them to understand that we don't want them to have a power plant. So my question to you is there any hope at all for talks, or do you see this administration is just so bullheaded and ignorant that they really won't do that and will proceed?
Talks with whom? You said, is there any hope for talks with whom?
With Iran, I'm sorry.
Iran.
Yeah, right.
Oh, well, you know, Iran isn't like Iraq. In Iraq, we wanted to occupy the country because we wanted the oil. Iran, as far as I can see, the overriding reason for a U.S. invasion of Iran will be because of Israel. The Israel wants it done, and the Israeli lobby here is pushing forward with no end. And the Israeli government speaks now, if we don't invade, if we don't bomb Iran, there will be a second Holocaust. That's the words they use. So it's not. There's no need to occupy Iran. What the U.S. wants to do is bomb the country so badly that its entire nuclear possibilities is wiped out and its military power is smashed. That's what they want to do. They won't have to use a ground invasion or an occupation to achieve that. Well, they hope to do so purely through air power. And of course, they'll kill many thousands of people in doing so. But they won't have to worry about the same kind of civil insurgency against them as in Iraq. But, you know, I'm surprised. In this past week, we heard that a meeting is taking place in the Middle East, including Iran and Syria and Iraq, and the U.S. is going to be present, which I find very encouraging. It may mean that at least for a week or so, the invasion the bombing is called off. I mean, the potential bombing scares me so that I'm happy to have even this guaranteed break for a week. That's how they scare me, this government. I never thought back in the 60s or 50s that I would be so scared by my own government. It's really amazing. But at least it's a break now. And maybe some headway is being made. Who knows what's going through the minds of those people in Washington.
Thank you.
I'd like to give you a couple of bandanas. In your book about Killing Hope, you have a long chapter about Nicaragua, what happened in Nicaragua in the 80s, and then in the book Rogue State, you have talked about what happened in the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima, Peru in 1997. This is going to be April 22nd of this year is going to be 10 years since the Peruvian military killed the people from the MRTA in the Japanese ambassador's residence. And I would like people to take some of these bandanas that I got in this box, and if you're going to any kind of political demonstration in the month of April of this year, to wear them over your face. And anyway, I think it's a big moment that the Sandinistas have retaken Nicaragua. So I'd like to give you one of their bandanas.
Thank you.
Here's your MRTA bandana.
Well,
maybe if I could just ask one question. I wanted you to address, if you would, the dramatic and horrendous erosion of civil rights under the neocons and this administration, including the eradication of habeas corpus, the excesses of the FBI that are being revealed now as they tap without court orders, the kind of invalidation of the Bill of Rights. The question is that going to be able to be reversed? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but many of us are wondering if there's hope to recapture the Bill of Rights and other civil rights.
Yeah, there have been some signs of that amongst the Democrats. They have been questioning the Patriot Act, for one thing. So I have some optimism about that, more than I do about foreign policy. Yeah. Thank you very much.
One more question.
One more question.
In terms of both Syria and Iraq, there's a notion, as you probably know, what the Fleck called the Ba'athist Party and the Ba'athist Movement, which is a pan-Arabist movement that's both secular, democratic, and socialist. And it really strives towards technological and industrial independence for the Arab world. In fact, major progresses were being made in terms of the Arab world, in particular Iraq and Syria, being economic, manufacturing, and technological giants in that part of the world. And with the United States invasion, they've set in motion these kind of feudal religious movements, which now are pretty much being brokered. Who's going to be in power? What is your critical analysis, dialectically speaking, of the Ba'athist movement of Syria and Iraq as a grand plan to move the Arab world into equality with the rest of the world?
I can't really speak about that. I'm not any kind of expert on the Ba'athist movement. But I do know that the changes in Iraq have been profound. I mean, you mentioned religion. I mean, Iraq was a really, before the invasion, was a secular society. And now women have, in some areas of the country, have to wear the full facial covering. Otherwise, they were attacked. It's very sad. But I can't talk any more detail about the Ba'athist movement.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Throughout your presentation, I was thinking about what might be some catalysts to ending our war economy that you have thought up.
What might be some...
What are some actions that people can take in the
local... ending the war economy.
To end our war economy, yeah.
That's a very basic foundation of our society, the war economy. I mean, you're asking... That's a very tough thing to do away with. You're talking about doing away with all the aspects of imperialism and doing away with the profit motive. I mean, that's pretty basic stuff. I don't. I can say one solution would be armed revolution. Are you ready for that?
Yeah.
But I something tells me that they have more weapons than we do. I think so. So I really can't advocate that. And if anyone is from the FBI is taking notes, I did not advocate that, okay?
But, like, for example, do you think we as people in the community have a right to close down military recruiting stations?
Do you have the right? You certainly have the moral right, yeah.
I know not legally. I know legally we don't.
To close down
an
army
recruiting station.
Recruiting station.
Any branch, yeah.
High school station.
Well, there has been some success on campuses, high schools and colleges, in several places at least. The army people have been forced to leave the campus and not come back. So that's certainly establishing a right, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
And certainly it's a very good movement.
I'm specifically referring to closing down the military recruiting stations and the stations that prepare these kids for basically like MEPS, the Military Entrance Processing Center. Yeah, they're the actual institutions that they have. Like, for example, one's off Rodeo and Martin Luther King Boulevard. Like, actually closing those institutions down. The actual place where they go to get their physical done here in the States.
The induction centers?
Yes. I guess that's what they're
called. And what's your question? How do we close them down?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Have you thought about going about it that way, closing down?
I have no thoughts on that subject.
No, not at all.
But there's any number of organizations which specialize in these things. You should contact them, not me. I don't want to sound like an expert when I'm not.
I understand. I appreciate it. Thank you, though.
I'm sorry.
Final question. Mr. Bloom, Dr. King expressed dismay that his country was the biggest purveyor of terror in the world. I'd like your comment on the following. It appears to me that people on the left adopt the language of the imperialists and people on the right in referring to foreign freedom fighters as terrorists, and they never refer to the U.S. as terrorists. So even you spoke of terrorists and spoke of the U.S. as a distinction. Can you comment on that?
The word terrorist is not necessarily a pejorative word. The word terrorist, as used by the FBI and the UN and other organizations, is simply the use of violence for a political end, or more specifically, violence against a population for the purpose of inducing the government to take certain actions which the terrorists want them to do. So that is a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your politics. So when I call someone a terrorist, I'm not always meaning it in a bad sense. It's a descriptive. And with the U.S. government, I have on occasion used the word terrorist to describe them. But I use other words which are just as bad or even worse. I mean, I'm not soft-soaping what the U.S. government does, obviously. You can't say that. I don't place that much weight upon the choice of the word. I've called the U.S. government terrorists. I've called Israeli government terrorists. Well, you know, someone said one man's terrorist is some other person's freedom fighter. So it's not as simple as your question might imply. Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk by William Bloom, State Department Cold Warrior turned radical scholar. Author of various books critical of U.S. policy, including Rogue State and Killing Hope. Thanks to the L.A. Sound Posse for that recording.
Have a word with your patron saint. Cover up the cracks with a lick of pen. All the exits are double locked, because Saint Sebastian sways but doesn't walk. Here's to you, you put up a fight. You're the last to leave, now turn out the light. You dance to the devil and the feathery wife. The Ordnance Survey is mapping out your life. Look at the small print, it's what we agree. Sign your name before we teach you how to read. This is the land of do what you're told. This is the land that do what you're told. I'm a celebrity, let me in here. One last jump from the end of the pier. We breached the wall, but I was too tired to run. My get up and go got up and now it's gone. Look at the small print, it's what we agree. We're going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet. They're filming it all for a reality show, so 12% we'll get.
This is the life.
We're going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet.
This is the life.
They're filming it all for a reality show, so 12% we'll get.
This is the life.
We're going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet.
This is the life.
They're filming it all for a reality show, so 12% we'll get.
This is the
we're going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet.
This is the
they're filming it all for a reality show, so 12% we'll get. We're going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet. They're filming it all for a reality show, so 12% we'll get.
The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto is the result of a decade of research during which Gatto sought to explain what he'd observed during his 3 decades as a teacher, that schools seem to be stunting rather than encouraging the intellectual development of American children. In contrast to Bloom, Gatto identifies himself politically as a libertarian, yet taken together, they illuminate the workings of imperial society. In prior chapters, Gatto has documented the expressed motivations of the powerful people behind the institution of compulsory schooling and the form it has taken, and how this was based on forms of social control seen in the British class system, the Prussian warfare state, and the introduction of industrial consumer society. Where we left off last time, Gatto explained how powerful industrialists and financiers had noticed how the social regimentation brought about by the Civil War created a profitable environment and desired that peacetime emulate the conformity of military life. Gatto wrote, quote, "With everyone dressing alike, eating alike, and doing everything else alike, maximum profit can be derived from the use of mass production machinery in an ideal environment where the goods of production are swiftly wasted and military consumers are literally forbidden the right to refuse to consume. A soldier must wear his uniform, eat his food, fire his rifle. To guarantee customers through psychological drills is the very essence of the corporate world about to come into being." Close quote. And so we continue. After the Civil War, the guaranteed customer was not a thing prudent businessmen were willing to surrender. Could there be some different way to bring about uniformity again without another conflict? Vast fortunes awaited those who would hasten such a jubilee. Consolidation, specialization, these were the magical principles President Harper was to preach 40 years later at the University of Chicago. Whatever sustained national unity was good, including war. Whatever retarded it was bad. School was an answer, but it seemed hopelessly far away in 1865. Things were moving slowly on these appointed tracks when a gigantic mass of Latin and then Slavic immigrants was summoned to the United States to labor in the 1870s and afterwards. It came colorfully dressed, swilling wine, hugging and kissing children, eyes full of hope. Latin immigration would seem to represent a major setback for the realization of any systematic utopia and its schools. But a president had been shot dead in 1865. Soon another was shot dead by a presumed, though not actual, immigrant, barely 15 years later. Rioting followed, bloody strikes, national dissension. It was a time tailor-made for schoolmen, an opportunity to manage history. The Americanization movement, which guaranteed forced schooling to its first mass clientele, was managed from several bases. 3 important ones were social settlement houses, newly minted patriotic hereditary societies, and elite private schools, which sprang up in profusion after 1880. Madison Grant was a charter member of one of the patriotic groups, the Society of Colonial Wars. All compartments of the Americanization machine cooperated to rack the immigrant family to its breaking point. But some, like settlement houses, were relatively subtle in their effects. Here, the home culture was inadvertently denigrated through automatic daily comparison with the settlement culture, a genteel world constructed by society ladies dedicated to serving the poor. Hereditary societies worked in a different way. Through educational channels, lectures, rallies, literature, they broadcast a code of attitudes directed at the top of society. Mainline Protestant churches were next to climb on the Americanization bandwagon, and the Home Missions Program became a principal gathering station for adoptable foreign children. By 1907, the YMCA was heavily into this work, but the still embryonic undertaking of leveling the masses lacked leadership and direction. Such would eventually be supplied by Francis Keller, a muckraker and a tremendous force for conformity in government schooling. Keller, the official presiding genius of the Americanization movement, came out of an unlikely quarter, yet in retrospect, an entirely natural one. She was the daughter of a washerwoman, informally adopted out of poverty by two wealthy local spinsters, who eventually sent her to Cornell, where she took a law degree through their generosity. After a turn toward sociology at the University of Chicago, Keller mastered Harper's twin lessons of specialization and consolidation and set out to boldly reform America's immigrant families. Her first muckraking book, Out of Work, was published in 1904. For the next 2 years, she drafted remedial legislation and earned her spurs lobbying. By 1906, she had Teddy Roosevelt's personal ear. 6 years later, she was head of the Progressive Party's publicity department and research arm. Keller, under William Rainey Harper's inspiration, became an advocate of industrial efficiency. She despised waste and disorder and urged that, quote, opportunity be rationalized and put under control. The first hint of school-to-work legislation to follow in the waning decades of the century. Work and licenses should be used as incentives to build national unity. Discipline was the ticket, and for discipline, carrots were required as well as sticks. Charles Evans Hughes, then governor, made Keller the first woman ever to head a state agency, appointing her director of the Bureau of Industries and Immigration in New York. By 1909, supported by prominent allies, she organized a New York branch of the North American Civic League, a Boston-based business-rostered outfit intended to protect the national status quo from various foreign menaces. Under her direction, the New York branch developed its own program. It isn't clear how much of the Boston agenda they carried on. It had mainly involved sending agents into immigrant communities to act as industrial spies and lead to anti-strike movements. But in any case, by 1914, Keller's group was writing its own menu. It opened by demanding centralized federal action. Americanization was failing without a national goal. Her new Committee for Immigrants in America thereafter proclaimed itself the Central Clearinghouse to unify all public and private agencies in a national spearhead to make all these people one nation. When government failed to come up with money for a bureau, Miss Keller's own backers, who included Mrs. Averill Harriman and Felix Warburg, the Rothschild banker, did just that, and this private entity was duly incorporated into the government of the United States. The Division of Immigrant Education, while officially federal, was in fact the subsidized creation of Francis Keller's private lobby. Immigrant education meant public school education, for it was to compulsion schooling the children of immigration were consigned. and immigrant children, in a reversal of traditional roles, became the teachers of their immigrant parents, thus ruining their families by trivializing them. When World War I began, Americanization took over as the great national popular crusade. A drive for national conformity pushed itself dramatically to the forefront of the public agenda. Keller and her colleagues swiftly enlisted cooperation from mayors, school authorities, churches, and civic groups, prepared data for speakers, distributed suggested agenda and programs, buttons, posters, and lectured in schools. When 4th of July 1915 arrived, 107 cities celebrated it as Americanization Day, and the country resounded with the committee's slogan, "Many peoples, but one nation." Now Keller's organization transmuted itself into the National Americanization Committee, shifting its emphasis from education to the breaking of immigrant ties to the old world. Its former slogan, "Many peoples, but one nation," was replaced with a blunt, "America first." In this transformation, children became the sharpest weapon directed at their parents' home culture. Keller called Americanization the civilian side of national defense. She appeared before a group of industrialists and bankers calling itself the National Security League to warn of coming peril from subversion on the part of immigrants. One of the most distressing anomalies confronting Keller and the NSL was an almost total lack of public sabotage incidents on the domestic front in World War I, which made it difficult to maintain the desired national mood of fear and anger. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. In 1916, the year of Madison Grant's Passing of the Great Race, Keller published Straight America. In it, she called for universal military service, industrial mobilization, a continuing military buildup, precisely engineered school curricula, and total Americanization, an urgent package to revitalize nationalism. America was not yet at war. President Wilson was, at that time, reading secret surveys which told him Americans had no interest in becoming involved in the European conflict. Furthermore, national sympathy was swinging away from the English and actually favored German victory against Britain. There was no time to waste. The war had to be joined at once. John Higham called it an adventure in high-pressure salesmanship. Thousands of agencies were in some measure engaged: schools, churches, fraternal orders, patriotic societies, civic organizations, chambers of commerce, philanthropies, railroads and industries, and to a limited degree, trade unions. There was much duplication, overlapping, and pawing of the air. Many harassed their local school superintendents. At the end of 1917, Minnesota's legislature approved the world's first secret adoption law, sealing original birth records forever so that worthy families who received a child for adoption, almost always children transferred from an immigrant family of Latin, Slav, Alpine peasant stripe to a family of Northern European origins, would not have to fear the original parents demanding their child back. The original Boston Adoption Law of 1848 had been given horrendous loopholes. Now these were sealed 69 years later. Toward the end of the war, a striking event, much feared since the communist revolutions of 1848, came to pass. The huge European state of Russia fell to a socialist revolution. It was as if Russian immigrants in our midst had driven a knife into our national heart, and by extension, that all immigrants had conspired in the crime. Had all our civilizing efforts been wasted? Now Americanization moved into a terrifying phase in response to this perceived threat from the outside. The nation was to be purified before a red shadow arose here too. Frances Keller began to actively seek assistance from business groups to build what she called the new interventionist Republic of America. At an unpublicized dinner meeting at Sherry's Restaurant near Wall Street in November 1918, Frances Keller addressed the 50 largest employers of foreign labor, warning them that Americanization had been a failure, that really dangerous times were ahead, with Bolshevik menace concealed in every workplace. Keller proposed a partnership of business and social work to break up the nationalistic racial groups. The easiest way to do that was to weaken close family life. Miss Keller, whose upbringing itself had been an ambiguous one, was the perfect person to lead such a charge. At the Wall Street meeting, plans were laid for a semi-secret organization of Americanizers to be formed out of interested volunteers from major industrial corporations. An impressive amount of money was pledged at the initial meeting, a story of which you can follow in John Higham's classic account of our immigration years, Strangers in the Land. The, quote, interracial council presented the external aspect of an eclectic, public-spirited enterprise. It even recruited some conservative immigrant representatives as members, but it was in fact controlled by Keller's backers. The IRC acted both as intelligence gathering office and propaganda agency. In its first year of existence, Keller put together an association of advertisers to strong-arm the immigrant press into running anti-radical propaganda. Using this muscle, immigrants could be instructed from far away how to think and what to think about, while remaining unaware of the source of instruction, because immediate pressure came from a familiar editor. Advertising revenue could be advanced as well as withdrawn, providing both carrot and stick, the complete behavioral formula. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. By 1919, a new deluge of state legislation appeared, specifically designed to counteract rampant Bolshevism. Idaho and Utah established criminal penalties for failure to attend Americanization classes. 15 states ordered English to be the only language of instruction in all schools, public and private. Nebraska demanded that all meetings be conducted in English. Oregon required every foreign language publication to display prominently a literal English translation of its entire contents. In 1922, Oregon outlawed private schools for elementary school children, a decision reversed by the Supreme Court later in Pierce v. Society of Sisters, 1925. At the same time, or just a bit later, a new biology began to emerge, a molecular vision of life under the direction of the Rockefeller Foundation, a vision in which scientific interventions could and should be used deliberately by the best people to control biological and social evolution. With Rockefeller as a principal engine, the shared social view of corporate thinkers was comprehensively imposed bit by bit on academic science. Elite universities, with Caltech as leader, became sites for the implementation of the Rockefeller Project. It was, in the words of Lily Kay in The Molecular Vision of Life, quote, a potent convergence of social agendas and scientists' ambitions, close quote. Eugenic goals played a significant role in conception and design of the new Rockefeller biology, to such a point that open discussion of purposes had eventually to be kept under wraps as a political liability, particularly when the great dictators of Europe appear to be taking some of their cues from America. Molecular biology promised a politically safer and even more certain path to an eventual utopia of social planning by elites, and one now properly scientific, completely free of the embarrassing candor of eugenic selection. The experience of these times gave reformers a grand taste for blood. Government intervention everywhere was proclaimed the antidote for dissent. Intervention took many unexpected shapes. For instance, the Athletes Americanization League agitated intensely to provide free sports equipment for every public school with its battle cry, "Sports are the logical antidote for unrest." By the time national passion cooled, in every nook and cranny of American life, new social organizations with powerful government or private sponsorship flourished. All fed on intervention into families for their nourishment, all clamored to grow larger, all schemed to produce political testimony of their value. A new republic was here at last, just as Herbert Croly had announced, and government school was to be its church. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, and that was the conclusion of Chapter 11. We'll continue with the next chapter next time. You can download this entire book for free online and learn more about John Taylor Gatto's work and ideas on the web at johntaylorgatto.com. Gatto is spelled with two T's, all one word. And you can download this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Hard by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shining black. Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all